This is Apologetics Profile.
Okay, I admit that I occasionally like watching high-definition videos of multi-million-dollar mansions, my favorites being those homes along the California coastline or those in the deserts of the American Southwest. If these earthly homes are so stunningly beautiful, it makes me wonder what the places Jesus is preparing for us might look like. Of course, I could never afford to live in one of these terrestrial works of art, but they are truly beautiful to behold. The drone flyovers at sunset, the clean architectural lines, perfectly manicured grounds, the soft ambient lighting, water sculptures, entire walls that can open and directly bring in the outdoors into the home, the views of the desert or ocean in the evening and morning. It's all so wonderfully breathtaking. But then there's the Abrams house. I don't know. Quirky, eclectic, ostentatious, 80s, how should it be described? It is certainly not the most aesthetically pleasing home I've ever seen, but look it up online and you be the judge. I would not want to live in it. Completed in 1982, this odd-looking, unorthodox domicile, tucked away in the affluent Pittsburgh community of Squirrel Hill, was designed by the late postmodern architect Robert Venturi and his wife Denise Scott Brown. The exterior featured a very non-traditional curving roofline, something like an ocean wave, with an enormous lime-green sun and its rays, which went off in every angle from near the front door. The large panes of glass above the entrance were stacked together to form something of a pixelated nautilus. The interior was a unique open floor plan, originally decorated with an eclectic array of primary colors and minimalist furniture pieces that looked more like something you might find on a kindergarten playground. Plenty of natural light found its way through the several large square windows, which made up nearly three-fourths of the back of the house. The roof and second story appeared to be resting directly on top of these panes. The original exterior colors were a mix of guacamole green and candy purple. It looked like something you might find at the bottom of the sea in SpongeBob's neighborhood. Is this something worthy of historical preservation, or is it an eyesore long overdue for demolition? For the last several years, the home has sat vacant while preservationists debated with the city council about the fate of the structure. In November of 2022, however, much to the disappointment of the preservationists, the long vacant and deteriorating Venturi designed structure had finally been demolished. In architectural circles, Robert Venturi's ideas and designs were known as postmodern architecture, a style that resists neat and tidy definitions and descriptions. As Venturi described his ideas, quote, "I like elements which are hybrid rather than pure, compromising rather than clean, distorted rather than straightforward, accommodating rather than excluding, inconsistent and equivocal rather than direct and clear. I am for messy vitality over obvious unity. An architecture of complexity and contradiction must embody the difficult unity of inclusion rather than the easy unity of exclusion." End quote. Venturi's style has been viewed by many as a kind of rebellion towards modern architecture, a style pioneered by American architect Philip Johnson in 1932 as International Modernism or International Style, and by the late German-American architect Ludwig Miles van der Rohe. One of the best examples of modern architecture is van der Rohe's Seagram Building in downtown New York. The dark rectangular skyscraper looks like an enormous window-covered version of the black alien monolith from 2001: A Space Odyssey. 2001 debuted in 1968, just 10 years after the completion of the Seagram Building, by the way. The modernist architectural style is, to oversimplify it a little bit, boxy, angular, and some would say rather plain, if not outright boring in terms of aesthetics. But it is also eminently practical in that many modernist structures afford occupants maximum interior floor space. Catherine McLaughlin of Architectural Digest notes in a 2023 article that, quote, "Modern architecture is the architectural style that dominated the Western world between the 1930s and the 1960s and was characterized by an analytical and functional approach to building design. Buildings in the style are often defined by flat roofs, open floor plans, curtain windows, and minimal ornamentation. Architects of the time were guided by the rule that form follows function, which prompted designers to consider what a building should achieve for the user before what it should look like. The aesthetic look of modern buildings was heavily correlated with a set of social-political philosophies, including the idea that buildings could be the answers to deep-rooted social inequalities." End quote. As McLaughlin has alluded to, before they became architectural fads, both modernism and postmodernism were philosophical ideas. The visual differences between Van der Rohe's Seagram Building and Venturi's Abrams House can perhaps serve us as visual examples of just how dramatically and radically different the philosophies of modernism and postmodernism actually are. Venturi's predilection for architectural style also serves as a good example of just how difficult it is to try to pin down a precise definition of postmodern philosophy. Venturi liked his structures to be distorted, inconsistent, full of complexity, contradiction, and messy vitality, whatever that might mean. And many who embrace a kind of postmodern philosophy might echo the exact same sentiment. There is no one overarching truth or story to our existence in the cosmos, according to postmodernism. Yes, there are individual stories, like the Abrams House, but there isn't any particular one right way to build something, whether it's a house or a way of life. Life is messy, often contrary and inconsistent, and our philosophical ideas should reflect that. In addition, those who adhere to a postmodern view of life believe that truth, like a quirky architectural design, is just something human beings create for themselves, rather than truth as something human beings discover as being unchanging and objective, a facet of modern philosophy. Postmodernists also are suspicious of the methods and tools of historians and social scientists today, virtually giving up on the idea that we can know anything objective about the past, especially if the past is invoked as part of a larger explanatory meta-narrative about ultimate reality. As postmodern philosopher Jean-François Lyotard famously quipped, postmoderns share a, quote, incredulity towards meta-narratives, end quote. These and other facets of postmodernism have crept into and continue to influence many people who are walking away from Christianity today. On the last few episodes of The Profile, we have been discussing the popular trend of hashtag deconstruction, what it is, where it came from, and what philosophical tributaries are presently feeding it. This week and next on The Profile, we continue our discussion about deconstruction and feature philosopher and president of New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary, Dr. Jamie Du, who is the co-author with Stuart Kelly of the 2017 book, Postmodernism, A Christian Perspective. Du sat down with me this past January at the Defend 2024 Apologetics Conference at the seminary to unpack just exactly what postmodernism is and how Christians can intelligently engage with those who are impacted by its influence. As we'll see, just like the Abrams House, postmodernism as a philosophy, especially in relation to its challenges to the truth of Scripture, stands empty and poised for demolition. As the Apostle Paul told the Corinthians, quote, "The weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses. We are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God, and we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ," end quote. Here on part one, Jamie gives us helpful background on modernist philosophy, when and how it began philosophically, and its relation to postmodernism. Jamie's insights are eminently helpful and easy to understand, and will equip you to be able to give a defense to those caught in the grips of postmodernism's distortions and contradictions. Here is the president of New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary, Dr. Jamie Dew.
Modernity is this, is you're looking at the 17th century here, 1600s. You have the birth in that century of two major movements, right? You have the birth of modern philosophy with René Descartes, and you have the birth of modern science. And I like to put, some scholars would maybe put this at somebody else's feet, but I like to put that at the feet of Francis Bacon. Sure, Isaac Newton is the better scientist of the day, no question about that, no argument there. But Bacon is really the one that introduces this inductive method into science as a way of doing science, and that's revolutionary. So here you are in one century within just a couple decades of each other, and modern philosophy is born, and then modern science is born.
Where is, let me interject really quickly, where is Robert Boyle in the midst of Francis Bacon?
Boyle is going to be another next generation.
Gotcha.
Down the road.
Gotcha.
He's going to be doing natural theology, and he's a phenomenal scientist doing natural theology. And but even that, the emphasis, the very strong emphasis that's going to come on natural theology is very much an Enlightenment modern project, because essentially what you've got it, with the birth of modern... Now, and understand, both of these men were Christians, right?
Mm-hmm.
Descartes is a Catholic. Bacon is Protestant. And both of these men are defending, in some ways, Christianity. But what they're also doing is they're frustrated, and they're taking great exception with the lack of intellectual progress in the centuries before them, right? So Descartes, for example, in the Discourse on Method, will talk at length about his frustrations about how, you know, after centuries and centuries and centuries of philosophical discourse, we don't have any real consensus, and what we really lack is any kind of certainty about our ideas and our theories and such. And so he's seeing historically the lack of certainty compared to mathematics, which has this ironclad logical rigor, certainty that it can produce. And
so modernity begins with a quest for epistemic certitude.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
They're both really, or at least with Descartes, definitely you can say epistemic certitude. I don't know that you could ever put that at the feet of Bacon, because he's using an inductive method, which by its very nature always leaves open the possibility that
something else
could be wrong. Yeah. But what you can say is both of them are looking for better, more confident, and more solid foundations for knowing, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So for Descartes, it is a certainty, and he thinks the way we do this, modeling after mathematics and the sort of the a priori nature of this, these movements, he thinks that we want to seat our knowledge most fundamentally in reason.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's a rationalist, and you're going to have multiple rationalists that come after him. And really what they're all trying to do is give us a better footing for knowledge, right? And it's the answer is going to be reason and philosophy, right? Then you turn over Francis Bacon, who's actually just a little bit before Descartes. He is looking backwards through history, and kind of like Descartes, he is frustrated with the lack of scientific progress, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's noted here that, you know, for centuries upon centuries, really since the time of Jesus and the time of Aristotle and Plato, we've not really made vast progress in technology, in medicine, things like this. And that's because he notes a number of reasons. One was a motive. Science was done prior to Bacon for doxological purposes, meaning you did it because you wanted to think God's thoughts after him. You wanted,
right.
you wanted to understand how things work so you can see how God did it and understand his thoughts, right? And certainly that's a beautiful idea, but that was merely what they were doing. That's all they were doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
He also noted that there's some fundamental flaws in our thinking. We call these the idols of the mind, right? The idol of the cave, idol of the marketplace. That is to say, we bias our theories towards language, we bias our theories towards popular opinion, and a number of other things like that. But the big thing that Bacon is taking exception with is the methodology of science up to him.
Okay. All right.
He argues that, and he's right, that ultimately, now it wouldn't surprise you that a philosopher would use deduction. In fact, Descartes had even suggested something like that.
Yeah.
But it would surprise us today to think that scientists were using deduction as their primary inferential methodology for drawing theories in science. But when we look back through science, that is indeed exactly what they were doing, following the Aristotelians. And he took, Bacon took great exception with the Aristotelians, not Aristotle as much. He actually saw Aristotle as a conversation starter, a getting the ball rolling kind of guy that he appreciated and esteemed. But it was all the Aristotelians, the people that came after him, that he really had scorn for, because he felt like they never continued on in what Aristotle actually was trying to do, and that is get the conversation going and help it to progress. No, they took his methodology and they etched it in stone, and you would draw inferences deductively. And here, a good example, and the parallels here, by the way, to biblical exegesis and hermeneutics broadly are just, this is all the bedrock of it.
Yeah.
Take, for example, like in the Bible, let's just switch. You know, we train our students to do exegesis, not eisegesis.
Mm-hmm.
Eisegesis is when you come to the text with your mind already made up, and you try to get the text to fit your interpretation, right? You do all your work to try to get it, round peg, square hole, get it to fit.
Mm-hmm.
Exegesis is when we come to the text and we let the details and the particularities of that passage or that chapter or that verse, we discover those things, we exegete them, we extract them out, and once we've really gotten our head around the details of what that text is actually saying, we let that text and those details determine for us what our theory ought to be. That's called exegesis. Well, there's a very real sense in which exegesis really just is an inductive practice, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's when induction is when we come to whatever we're exploring or considering. In this Bacon's case, it was nature and science. And we don't already have our mind made up with a theory of what it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
But we let the particularities and the details dictate to us what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And we're letting the particulars, so to speak, of, say, stars and heat and things like that, determine for us what the theory ought
to be. So induction, we come at nature without presuppositions.
That's correct.
Ideally.
That's correct.
Okay.
And what Bacon is noting, and that's very common from Bacon forward, but prior to Bacon, this is what he's frustrated with. All these other scientists in the past had really been doing almost like a deductive, eisegetical interpretation of nature.
We already know what nature is.
That's right. And a good example of that is Copernicus. You know, so like Copernicus discovers that the Earth is not the center of the universe.
He didn't even have a telescope.
I know.
Pretty cool.
So Galileo is going to come behind him and find with a telescope that he's right. But Copernicus comes to that conclusion mathematically.
Mm-hmm.
But so Copernicus is an astronomer and a mathematician that the church hires. And why would in the world would the Catholic Church hire astronomers and mathematicians? It's because they needed to map out the calendars for the years and decades to come so they could develop their liturgies. So they needed to know.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, by the way, Jimmy, he doesn't have a whole lot of nice things to say about religion, but he says, one thing I'm just going to say Christianity got right was the calendar.
Yeah, that's right.
The Gregorians knocked it out.
That's right, we did. And so they're hiring him to do that kind of work. And when he sits down to try to map out the movements of the stars in the sky, you've got these little things called epicycles. It's moving across an arc, and then all of a sudden it'll do a backwards loop in that arc and then keep going.
Have you
arc.
Ever read this section on epicycles in Richard Burton's Anatomy of Melancholy?
No.
It is hilarious. You need to check that out.
Yeah. To use those maps, you're saying essentially that all of a sudden stars and their movements across the sky stop and do U-turns.
Every astronomer from, so it really was Tycho Brahe and Kepler that were sitting in both worlds.
Yeah.
But at the time of Brahe and Kepler and prior to this, Burton is like, look, everybody's got their loops. Everybody's lost their minds.
Right.
He has
right.
50 loops. He has 60 epicycles.
Right.
He has epicycles within epicycles. This whole thing needs to fall down.
Yeah, it does. And so Copernicus is seeing this, and what he determines is that the real problem are the assumptions we're coming into this work with. The assumptions are we already know what these stars are doing, and now we're going to try to get the data that we find to fit it. They were operating deductively and eisegetically.
Yeah.
And he realizes we've got to actually look at what's happening and then develop our maps and our theories
there. It was the supernova that Tycho Brahe saw in 1574 and Kepler saw one in 1604, the last two supernovas in our galaxy that changed.
Yeah.
What's going on out there, the sphere above the moon. It's like, well, wait a minute, that's outside the realm, and space in that time never changed.
That's
it was immutable and represented God's glory. But so you're right, I like that, how you're well, Bacon didn't like it, where you had the natural philosophers coming at nature thinking that they already know it is. And I think, you know, in the modern era here too, I think science is always wrestling with that.
Yeah.
In model building.
Yeah.
Right?
That's right.
We're coming at the universe. We already know this, 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 and this. And we allegedly are likely, would like to be open-minded.
Right.
But in a sense, there's a lot of effort to save a model.
Yeah.
Before it actually
changes.
That's
correct. That's correct. And so just pause here and kind of take away from these two figures, the Descartes and the movement he launches, and Bacon and the movement that he launches. Essentially what you've got now in one century, the birth of modern philosophy, birth of modern science, and both of them are looking for more sure, steady, and solid foundations for our knowing. And we should say that there is, in fact, progress that comes from these figures.
Yeah, I mean, there is, right.
Take Bacon, for example. Now with a new methodology of induction, we genuinely begin to start uncovering the mysteries of the universe. Mm-hmm. And within, I mean, check it, I say this to my students all the time. Think about it, from the time of Plato and Aristotle and long before, all the way up until really Descartes, until Bacon, it's candles, it's horse and buggy, it's dying of common colds, and then all of a sudden, within a couple hundred centuries, we're putting people on the moon, we're doing open heart surgery, we've got this stuff now called artificial intelligence, we've got the knowledge expansion, and specifically the knowledge expansion of the natural world, modern physics and such.
Right.
It worked. He was right. We get a new methodology, and this is why I put it at the feet of Bacon, by the way, and not Newton. Sure, Newton was the better scientist per se, but imagine somebody bakes a delicious cake, and you praise him for that cake. Well, I'm grateful they made me that delicious cake, and I will say thank you for it. But the person I really want to thank is the person who wrote the recipe, right?
And
that's the way I look at Bacon here. You know, Isaac Newton's going to be the better scientist, the better practitioner of it. But Bacon, with the introduction of induction, really gives us a methodology that gets this all going. And now from that, we refer to modernity and into the Enlightenment as the age of science and reason.
So is it fair to say, Jamie, that modernity really is a kind of a quest for two things. One, a kind of epistemic certitude in some respect.
Yeah.
But also what comes out of this, maybe unintentionally, is a sort of idolizing, not initially with Bacon, because he was trying to take the initiative to find something that's something different. Something's not working. We need to find something different. But what seems to happen is that the scientific methodology becomes enthroned.
Yeah.
And what starts to happen, the queen of the sciences, which is theology, becomes a slave to the science.
That's correct. So by the time you get to Immanuel Kant, Kant is suggesting these magisterial usages of reason and science over and above theology. So, you know, the very title of the work that he wrote, Religion Within the Bounds of Reason Alone, is saying this, that, you can have your religious perspectives, but they have to line up with, they have to check in, so to speak.
They're no longer magisterial.
Right. They have to check in with science and reason, and science and reason really do replace the Judeo-Christian perspectives on ultimate explanations for reality. So you could say at this point, to start taking us to what we're talking about today with postmodernism, what you've got now at this point, because you have science and reason that now emerge, and let me just say this real quick. Look, there's a very real sense in which the hopes and aspirations that they had for modern science were successful.
Yeah.
Again, we're putting people on the moon. We're flying in airplanes. You and I probably take prescription medicines now.
Well, Boyle is a chemist, inherited part of this methodological approach to nature.
That's
absolutely
right. So I mean, a lot of this stuff works. Mm-hmm. You and I live in a very modern world, and our lives are intertwined with it now. So it works in a lot of ways. And the knowledge that it gains is empirically verifiable in so many different ways. Mm-hmm. As opposed to, and there's a little bit of stuff you could say about Descartes on this, as opposed to religious paradigms, where when a preacher says something or a religious scholar says something, they'll say, well, we take this by faith. I'm not saying every religious person does it that way. But what you've got is this very fideistic approach in religion, that is, just have faith, versus science, which is, you know, making these, drawing these theories and backing them up with tons of evidence, right, and experiments and observation and stuff. It's no wonder that by the time you and I are born into this world in the 20th and 21st century, it's no wonder, therefore, that people on whole largely have confidence in what scientists say.
Mm-hmm.
Now, COVID disrupted that a little bit.
A little bit.
But it, largely people have confidence in what scientists say, and they don't have a lot of confidence in what religious people say.
And you have the burgeoning growth of, and this is so ubiquitous today, especially among a younger generation of people that are self-identifying as non-believers or nuns, is this idea that empirical knowledge is really sort of the only kind of knowledge that is, at least not the only kind of knowledge, but the best kind of knowledge or the most certain kind of knowledge. And then faith, because it's not falsifiable and it doesn't fit in with the scientific paradigm of induction and methodological approaches to things, we can't take it seriously.
That's right. So you've got, from this, the emergence of science and reason as sort of the kings, and this lack of confidence that begins to accumulate on religious perspectives.
Right.
We shift from the Judeo-Christian paradigms that really dominated the Western world from the time of Christ all the way into the 17th century to the age of science and reason. And we could now say it this way. This starts to get us towards the postmodern questions.
Mm-hmm.
There's a meta-narrative shift. Meta-narratives are overarching explanations of reality, right? So what does that mean? Well, it means this. Prior to the 17th century, if somebody asked a question, what's truth or where does truth come from? The Bible. Where'd the world come from? God and such.
Mm-hmm.
What's the purpose of my life? To honor God. Notice how in these cases, God is the ultimate explanation for our knowledge, for reality, for purpose. That all gets dethroned. And now in the age of science and reason, where does this all come from? Some kind of big explosion, some kind of evolutionary process. How do we know things? Science.
Well, and it's interesting, Jamie, because what you're describing is kind of what we already have in Romans 1, the tectonic shift, mm-hmm. if you will, from worshiping God to worshiping the creature and four-footed things. And I notice in the sciences today that the language of, like if you listen or read evolutionary constructs of reality or Big Bang cosmology, the particles and the substances are the things to which divine attributes are being given. The particles create
magical
themselves.
Magical powers.
They have forces, and they combine, and they make things, and they arrange, and they do all these things.
They have a teleology.
I was listening to an astronomer talk about mature galaxies,
mm-hmm.
and that's a loaded word, because his idea of a mature galaxy were the giant spirals in the distant part of the universe.
Right.
I'm like, well, mature galaxies is an assumption.
Right.
About the universe, of a long, slow, gradual process that actual galaxies have teleology of being giant spirals.
Yeah.
You know, we know what an acorn teleology is. It goes from, you're not getting anything out of a tree, but the same the same assumptions apply in cosmology. Well, we start with the acorn of the atom, the proton, and the neutron, and that these things somehow just aspire to big swirly spirals of stars. There's nothing, but it's taking theological language and throwing it on the cosmos and getting rid of God.
Yeah, and you know, it's all, there's a sense in which the pendulum is swung in full at this point,
right?
So the modernity all and the Enlightenment, it all begins with a hard rejection of any of those types of teleologies and purposive types of things in nature, that nature is purposeless, that there is a nobody out there, there is no purpose behind all this stuff. It's just brute facts and mathematical formulations and physical objects, and that's just all there is.
Yeah.
To now, and so that very modern perspective pushes forward the beginning of the 20th century. You know, it was widely thought that physics as a discipline was done. They had learned.
Yeah, they thought they'd learned everything.
Everything
right.
that there was to know about physics. Well, not only was that wrong, as it turned out, the 20th century, we learned more about the physical universe, and our physics developed more in that one century than all of the prior centuries before it. I mean, this is Einstein is functioning in this century with his theories of relativity. We discover quantum physics and things of this nature. I mean, the more we learn about the universe itself with Hubble telescopes and how big and expansive this whole thing is, what happens is the grandeur of it all And what we discover is that the universe is vastly more mysterious, more complicated than we thought it was. Things that we once thought could happen just as brute facts don't seem to really be possible that way.
Yeah.
And so now all these theorists are in a position where they have to begin, once again, positing things like teleology and purpose and things like that as though it's sort of a built-in feature to the furniture and the fixtures of the universe. And so it's a very interesting moment we're in to see them doing that.
And the idea that the universe, the burgeoning idea in cosmology, the universe has to be contingent. It's dependent upon... I've talked to a lot of non-Christian physicists and scientists who look at the laws of the universe as having causal power.
Right, right.
Because, well, it's math and the laws. And look, we can do the math. But if you write E equals MC squared or some other formula on a chalkboard, it's not going to change the chalkboard. The math can't be causal, but yet they understand intuitively that there is a need for the universe is contingent and it has to be sustained by something and it must be the laws of
physics.
That's right.
So, interesting stuff to see how it all develops.
Right.
But all that to say, I mean, look, modernity had some very interesting and very helpful. The modernity was right about a lot of things. But it was wrong about some things as well. Maybe it'd be helpful just to kind of walk through just real quick a couple of the motifs that you'll find in modernity. So, you know, when you think about modernity, here's a couple things I think you could say that really motifs that would summarize it. Number one, there is the elevation of human reason in both philosophy and science. So it's the age of science and reason.
That becomes the foundational certitude that Descartes was looking for.
That's right.
And it becomes maybe a burgeoning overconfidence in human
reason.
That's
correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. You could say in large part with at least the rationalists and Descartes, there's this quest for certainty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, in large part, epistemically speaking, most folks today would think that to know something is to have absolute certainty. Whether or not you and I can achieve that about everything we know is a different philosophical question, but that is a motif that you'll find in this era. You have the introduction of what we call classical foundationalism, that maybe the way our knowledge is secured is by finding the right foundations and building up upon that, right? And all these, by the way, all these motifs are going to be motifs that post-modernity is going to reject.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
A big one here is the denial of what we call essentialism, that there are essences, that there are natures, right? You're going to start to see that, and this really predates modernity to William of Ockham and such, but it's certainly by the time you get to modernity, the scientific paradigms in particular, and frankly even the philosophical ones, are going to deny these essences and natures.
Is it because, do you think it's because, Jamie, that... that we can't, when we're doing induction as Bacon would want to have it done, that you couldn't see these essences, maybe?
Well, yes. I mean, that's part of it. I mean, people often hear of Occam's razor, right? So Occam's razor basically says, if you've got a choice between a simple explanation of something and a complicated explanation of something, always go with the simple explanation. The more elegant, simpler, straightforward explanation, as long as it actually explains everything it's supposed to explain, then that's probably going to be the right explanation. And so there's this preference, so to speak, for these simpler explanations.
Okay.
That's called Occam's razor. Well, that was first, and that gets utilized that way in the sciences all the time. And I don't have any beef with that. I think that's legit to do that. The origination of that principle, though, had to do with this question of essences.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
And so you have a ball, right? And that ball is laying there, and the philosophers go to explain the ball. Well, what is it to be a ball? And one person who believes in universals and these essences would say, well, you've got the physical stuff that this is, but it possesses this form or this universal called ballness. And so there's this other thing called ball nest that's out there floating, and then you got individual ball on the table, right? All right, so you got two layers to your explanation. You got the ball on the table, and you got this metaphysical thing called a form.
Mm-hmm.
And Occam comes along and says, well, that's a complicated explanation. What if you just said, nope, you just have a ball, and that's just all there is to it?
Yeah.
There is no form out there
right.
that it's reflecting or something. And so the simplicity of that was really what drove that. And that's a lot of where it's coming from.
Okay.
Simpler explanations.
Gotcha.
Modernity is going to be big on objectivity. Bacon in particular, the method of induction. He wants to, and Descartes does too. Both of these movements are passionate about stripping out subjectivity in the way we're perceiving, encountering, and interpreting nature and the world around us.
And that starts to become the epistemic acid of the loss of self.
That's right.
Isn't it?
That's right, yeah. So this is going to, you're going to, anything subjective you want to strip out, right? So I am a 47-year-old white male that lives in the South. And so I may very well look at the world in a certain way. My experiences, my background, my education, my hardships, my successes in life all may shape my view of things and cause me to look at the world in a certain way. And modernity noted this and then therefore developed methodologies, induction and such, that attempted to strip all that out and be as objective as it could possibly be in everything
wow.
that it does.
And they're not trying to get rid of the self, but it seems like... It seems like that's what's happening. I mean, you are getting, because we are subjects.
That's right.
How do you eliminate the subject?
Yeah.
You know, how do you do that?
So, yeah, certainly the moderns are not at that point trying to get rid of
right.
the self. That's going to be a very unique postmodern feature much
mm-hmm.
later.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is going to be there that these, so that ties into the next one. Let me say this. That there's this uniform rationality, this universal rationality that all people everywhere can have. Right. So the idea was, is that, hey, look, man, as long as we're all thinking rightly, we will draw the same conclusions.
Mm.
And that was an easy thing to think when your context and your frame of reference was Europe. Right. Because
yeah.
most Europeans did have a very similar way of reasoning
right.
and processing. But when modern sociology and modern anthropology really get up and going and we begin discovering people groups around the world in the mm-hmm. far-flung corners of the universe, of the world, you know, we discover how people in Africa live, what their customs are like, what their reasoning and rational processes are
very
like.
Non-European.
Very much. Or Asians or
yep.
South Americans or such. What we discover is that, well, no, they don't do that at all. But modernism said there's these uniform ways of thinking and there's these uniform natures, right? So now take that, you know, think about the way those ideas can be misused, right? And in fact, in fairness to postmoderns, there is a track record here in the Western world of misusing those things. So take things like human nature.
Mm-hmm.
There's this idea that human nature is this one thing. And oh, as it turns out, that one thing that it is said to be is an awful lot like white males and white males in particular, but white females, white folks. So if you're a person of color, if you're a female or other things like that, oftentimes it was felt and at times maybe even practiced that these were oppressive ideas on underrepresented groups of people
mm-hmm.
and things
mm-hmm.
like that.
So we have this, the postmodern critique of modernity is power grab in some sense.
That
that's
right.
We're using these essences to dominate and to be powerful.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So postmoderns are going to come along and say every last bit of that stuff y'all were saying about fixed essences and what human nature is, human nature, postmoderns would argue, was a weaponized concept by modernity, which happened to be a lot of white ruling people to suppress and harm other people. So, I mean, and quite literally, slavery, modern slavery, is an example of this very thing.
Look what Leopold did in the Congo.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's African-Americans were seen as non-humans,
mm-hmm.
non-persons, and therefore they, in their mind, were therefore free to take them, enslave them, punish them, beat them, kill them, do with them whatever they wanted to do. And certainly the same types of things with other groups as well. Jewish people have experienced this. Handicapped people have experienced this. Females have experienced this. There's lots of examples throughout history
mm-hmm.
where the idea of a fixed nature, so to speak, was a weaponized.
Well, Hitler,
nature.
Obviously.
Yep.
Nazi Germany. Yeah,
that's right.
Mm-hmm.
So you had these motifs coming out of modernity. And ultimately what postmodernity is it's a rejection of every last one of those things, right?
It's not a rejection with an alternative. It's just almost like an anarchy in some sense. We're just going to raise the whole thing to the ground almost, is it?
In a lot of ways, yes. There's one way that I might caveat that a little bit. So a major motif, I didn't mention this one, I should have. This might be the most fundamental one of all. One major motif of modernity was the idea of truth. You know,
yeah.
And truth, generally speaking, not just in modernity, but historically.
Going back to Pilate and Jesus?
Yeah, this
what
is the
truth?
Way it's thought of.
Right.
Truth has always been considered in a correspondence fashion.
Yes.
So, for
example,
I walk down the road and I say to my friend, hey, look, the traffic light is red. And he looks up and he knows that I'm telling him the truth. Well, how? How does he know that I'm telling them the truth? Well, it's because the statement, the traffic light is red, corresponds to reality itself. As it turns out, the traffic light really is red. I say to my friend, hey, I'm wearing my Bo Jackson Nikes today. And he looks down at my feet and he says, he knows I'm telling him the truth. Because, again, the statement corresponds to reality. So correspondence theory of truth basically just says a statement is true if, in fact, it corresponds to reality.
And the postmoderns made a mess of that by saying that those the red light, the Bo Jackson shoes are all social constructs.
Social constructs or some kind of instrumental statements that help us navigate the world. And
they're not objectively real. They're just sort of creations of...
That's right.
Yeah.
So here, they do fully reject correspondence theory, okay? But then you'll hear people, critics of postmodernism, especially Christians, we want to critique them, and I get this, they'll say, you often hear Christian critics of postmodernism say, they reject truth. Eh, yes and no. Yes in the sense that they do reject correspondence theory, no question.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not to say that they don't have a, quote, theory of truth. And here, postmoderns will go one of two directions.
This is Apologetics Profile, a weekly podcast equipping you to engage the world of non-Christian ideas, beliefs, and spiritual practices. For Watchman Fellowship, I'm Anna Marie Smuts.